Well, hello, it's the top of the hour, and I want to welcome you to another lesson in the Lead Yourself First program. I'm Tom Cooper, and I'm so glad that you have joined me for today's lesson. Today, we're talking about connecting with other people at work. Now, Lead Yourself First is your personal growth program. Zig Ziglar said, you can have anything you want in life if you help enough other people get what they want. And Lead Yourself First is your system to help you find and start using the tools that are going to help you help others get what they want so that you can get what you want. I work hard to make sure that each of these lessons is able to stand on its own, that each one contains practical, interesting, and entertaining information so you could take even one of these lessons and make it your focus for a season and help you develop mastery in that one single area. And this lesson, like each lesson in the program, is designed to bring you the best information and the best ideas that I can find on these topics so you can use what we talk about to help you get better results. Now, overall, as you participate in Lead Yourself First, this program is designed to help you be able to move up the ladder, to gain influence and respect among your team members and your leaders so that you can be seen as a catalyst to make good things happen with your team. I believe in you, and I believe in your dream to grow, and I know there's a ton of potential inside you that can be unlocked and can deliver great results. Now, this program is based on the idea that each player on the team has the ability to stretch and grow, and if you can start right where you are now, you'll be amazed at what results you can start to create in your life. So, we're getting ready to get started. And my question for you this lesson and for all these lessons is, how are you going to act after this lesson's over? What's something you can apply? What's something you can change? And what's something you can teach? Now, you know, something you can use from our lesson today. How can you use what we're talking about to really help you move forward? Change, what's something you've been doing a certain way and now you're going to flip it and do a different way? And then teach, I do not mean get on a call like this and teach. What I mean is, what can you do to share an idea from this time with other people? Because when you begin to do that, you become that river, not a reservoir, and that unlocks your potential. It helps you by locking into your brain the thing we're talking about. I know I say it a lot that I was looking forward to today's lesson, but I have been looking forward to this lesson because I've learned through painful personal experience what happens when we overlook the human side of work. And I look forward to it because I know that if I can leave you with just a few key ideas and you use them, you'll be able to achieve in weeks what it took me years to be able to do. Over the next few minutes, we're going to unpack some gold when it comes to dealing with people. If you take just one thing that I tell you in this lesson, just one thing, and put it into practice for the next 30 days, you'll be astonished at what happens. And maybe for you, you really want to dig into this topic and go deeper. And if that's you at the end of this lesson, I promise I'm going to share with you a way that we can work together and you can do that. Fair enough? All right, so as we start this lesson, I have a startling stat that had startled me every time I see it, and certainly the first time I came across it. But 87% of your success at work is people skills. 87%. And if you are not investing in others, I did a workshop this week, and there was a leader in the organization who was at the workshop, and he said, I'm not a people person. Well, here's the thing. If you're not investing in your connection with other people, I guarantee it's harming your effectiveness. So our lesson today, we're going to talk about three big ideas. One is that human connection is the heart of all productive work. Second, people work is the work. Tasks are secondary. And third, I'm going to list for you six ways, Dale Carnegie says, to make a connection with other people. Now, I work with senior leaders in organizations all the time, and if there's one thing I hear most often, it's, why can't people just do their job? Why can't people do their job? Well, unfortunately, the answer is because we don't value them highly enough to invest in them or even invest in ourselves to continue to grow. And regardless of your position or your role, you have the ability to make a difference in the lives of the people you work with. If you begin to communicate value to others, you're going to find that they will deliver more for you. You don't have to be the boss in order for that to be the case. This is a significant thing to know, that regardless of your title, regardless of the role that you have the opportunity to be able to impact other people, and that's what's really powerful. I have a confession to make. I'm an extrovert, but man, do I love getting tasks knocked out. It gives me great joy to take something that was on my to-do list and mark it done. On the flip side, it's kind of a gut punch when I think I've got something completely done, and it turns out not to be done, and it goes right back on my to-do list. And my confession is that I love getting stuff done so much that, well, it often gets in the way of my relationships with other people. And I can recall, to my embarrassment, how many times I've been in a situation where I focus so much on the thing to get done, and I've stomped on people. And that's just not how I want to live, but it's a reality for me. And the science is clear on this, that studies show that the people stuff is just more important than the tasks. Human connection is the heart of all productive work. I found that when I began to understand that, and I invested in connecting with my team members, it dramatically improved my effectiveness. When I focused on checking the tasks off on the task list and ignored the personness of the people on my team, my productivity plummeted. But when I took care of the people, they took care of the tasks, and everybody was more productive and happier. Now, one of these ideas that I want to cover here is how valuable kindness is. It seems counterintuitive, but it really does have significant value. Now, you may have outdoor clothing that you wear that's made from polar tech or polar fleece. And the company that makes these materials is called Malden Mills. And the owner of the company is a deeply religious man named Aaron Feierstein. Now, on December 31st, 1995, his factory caught fire and burned to the ground. The factory employed 3,400 workers, and it was the main employer for two neighboring towns. At one time, the area had many mills, but most of those mills had closed over time or moved to areas where they could pay people less money. And Mr. Feierstein felt that people should be paid a decent wage, and he refused to move his factory. Now, the fire occurred on his 70th birthday, and the workers believed that was the end of the line for their jobs. Surely Mr. Feierstein would take the $300 million in insurance money and call it quits. But even while smoke was still rising from the charred remains of the factory, Mr. Feierstein called his workers together at a school gymnasium, and he spoke with them. They were about to discover just what kind of man they worked for. He announced he was not going to abandon them. He was going to rebuild the factory, and he told them he was going to keep all 3,400 of them on the payroll for 1 month, and each of them would get a $275 Christmas bonus. Once the factory was rebuilt, they would all get their jobs back. Grown men wept in the audience as he spoke. After the first month ended, he paid them for another month. After the second month ended, he paid them for a third month. It cost him $1.5 million a week to do this, and he also paid their hospitalization insurance. How did his employees respond to that? Well, they responded by salvaging what equipment they could, and in temporary buildings got production up to what it was before the fire while the new factory was being built. Mr. Feierstein received much praise from around the country, but he said he only did what was the moral and right thing to do. He used his money to support his beliefs in God rather than make money his God. Now, as you live your life, you might try to remember his example and treat people with fairness and kindness. It's amazing the power that comes with that. Mr. Feierstein valued people over profits, and he's not alone. There was a study that was done of 16,000 executives, and of those 16,000 executives, 13% were high achievers. And what they found about that 13% that was in common is that they tended to care about people as well as profits. They viewed their subordinates in an optimistic fashion. They sought advice from their team members, and they listened. It's not that Mr. Firestein didn't care about profits. He valued people highly, and he was willing to sacrifice in the short term for the long-term outcome. And that's something all of us can consider. There's really good, solid data on how being people-focused can make a big difference in teamwork, in productivity, in engagement, and in morale. Building a positive work environment where we care about our team members, it pays. Now, part of today's lesson is pulled from How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. It's one of my favorite books. I read it pretty regularly. Maybe once a year I'll sit down and read through it because I forget some of the great information that's there. And I'm going to be sharing some from his book today. One of the things that I want to pull out is this quote from John Dewey that said, The deepest urge in human nature is the desire to be important. The desire to be important. This is such a big deal that, frankly, most of How to Win Friends and Influence People is focused on tools and techniques to address that very need. And this need to be valued by others often goes unmet. Many people go through life with this need unmet, and it causes them to make choices that lead to bad outcomes for them. Thoreau said, "The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. Most people are unfulfilled and long for appreciation." Do you want to be a person who's able to get the most from other people? If you can learn to address this core need to feel important, to be important, it's going to give you a serious edge. In fact, philosopher William James said, "The deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated." The craving to be appreciated. Carnegie actually said, "Here is a gnawing and unfaltering human hunger. And the rare individual who honestly satisfies this heart hunger will hold people in the palm of his or her hand." Just think about that. If you can honestly satisfy the heart hunger of others, you could hold people in the palm of your hand. And this has been proven true over and over and over again. One of the first employees in U.S. history to be paid over $1 million a year was a man by the name of Charles Schwab. Now, why? Why would any employer pay somebody that much money? In 1921, it was an insane amount of money. Schwab said that his salary was based on his ability to deal with people. He said, "I consider my ability to arouse enthusiasm among my people the greatest asset I possess. And the way to develop the best that is in a person is by appreciation and encouragement. There is nothing else that so kills the ambitions of a person as criticism from superiors." Schwab also went on to say, "In my wide association of life, meeting with many and great people in various parts of the world, I have yet to find the person who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than a spirit of criticism." Kindness is valuable. It's much more productive than criticism. As I was preparing this lesson, I was reminded, I was about 19 years old, and I was working as a server in a restaurant to pay for my way through school. And there were several managers who oversaw daily operations in the restaurant, most of whom were not like Charles Schwab. I often remember hearing, "If you got time to lean, you got time to clean," as if it was an inspirational message from on high. In general, I was not the best employee in the world, but I was a decent worker. I was polite, I showed up on time for work, and most of the time I had happy customers. And I was decent at my job, and I had a pretty good reputation in the restaurant. Well, late one evening, there was a group of about 15 or 20 people that came, and they cleared my section just for that party. And as I was scrambling over the next couple of hours to take orders and refill drinks and make sure everybody had everything they needed, I was swamped. I was really, really busy. And I decided that, well, I thought I deserved to take a bit of a shortcut. And so typically what I would do as a party was going on, is I would I'd clear the dishes and I would take them back to the dishwasher as I went. You know, whether I would be delivering appetizers, entrees, and desserts, and coffee, you know, over each of those different segments of the meal, I'd have a chance to run things back. So in this scenario, I was tired, and I decided that I was going to set a set up a tray in the server area, and then I would not have to make that run all the way back to the kitchen. So I, over time, though, that stack of plates and cups and silverware, well, it got higher and higher, and I rearranged them to be more efficiently stacked up. But by the time that party left and I had collected my tip, there was a veritable mountain of dishes piled high on the tray. It was, without question, the biggest stack of dishes I'd ever created in my time as a server. So at that point, I made another choice. Rather than carry the dirty dishes a little at once, a little at a time, to the kitchen, I decided that I was going to lift the whole thing and make one single trip to the kitchen. It really was a continuation of my theme there that evening of cutting corners. Why waste all that energy on multiple trips? At the restaurant, the management had done everything they could to reduce waste. In fact, they had tried to impress upon us the cost of operations and the cost of the plates and the silverware and the dishes that we used. And they had a wall-sized chart next to the dishwasher that had an outline of every single plate and the retail price of every item that was there. They didn't want us to lose or throw away or break the plates. So here I am standing back in the wait station, and I squatted down next to the heaping tray of plates, and I used up all of my young leg and back muscles to lift that tray and heft it up to a balance point on my shoulder and one arm. I carefully navigated my way from the remote corner of the restaurant to the dishwashing station. Now, arriving in the kitchen, I began to use my free hand to set up a tray stand on which I planned to place that heavy tray. The flick of my wrist to deploy the tray stand was just the off-balance input that that tray needed. I remember watching in horror as I saw the stack of dessert plates on the very edge of the front of the tray slip and then fall off the front. As the stoneware plates began their descent toward the tile floor, this small shift in the weight distribution was enough to cause the barely balanced heavy tray to tip over backwards, and I was powerless to stop what had become the inevitable. Dozens of plates met their demise on the merciless, hard tile floor below. The noise of the cacophony was astonishingly loud. And here I am, tired, sweaty, and surrounded by sharp, broken, dirty plates all around me. I sighed and began picking up the broken pieces and putting them in the trash can, and it took me quite a while to get through the debris, and only one or two of the plates was salvageable from the entire stack. I've been working on this for a while, and I was about 75% of the way through the mess when I heard the door to the restaurant office shut. I knew that my manager was on her way to discuss with me what had happened. And I was in big trouble. I had made a series of foolish choices and culminated in this very foolish choice. And I had been solely responsible for hundreds of dollars in destroyed plates. The manager on duty that night, she was a lady that I particularly liked, and I wasn't sure whether she'd still like me after what I had done. Now, I can't tell you as I stand here today whether she had studied Dale Carnegie's material, but as she approached me, she wasn't angry. And she asked a question. She said, "Did what I think just happen actually happen?" I was too scared to speak. I nodded. And in my mind, I remember, I was thinking, what's about to happen? She had me dead to rights. I had no escape. There was no excusing what I had done. What would she do? Would I lose my job? Would I have to pay for all those plates? And she looked at me and said, quietly and firmly, "Let's not let that happen again, okay? And I nodded. And then she turned and she left, and I never heard anything more about it again. I was stunned. Her mercy toward me in that moment was amazing, and I was grateful. You see, she didn't approach me with a spirit of criticism, and let me ask you, how do you think that affected my opinion of her? What do you think happened the next time she needed something from me? I can tell you this, I was always grateful for her kindness. I knew how stupid I'd been, and I knew the consequences to the company, and every other manager would have screamed at me in that moment. But their passionate, angry words would not have had anywhere near the same impact as her quiet comments had on me. She showed me kindness in a moment where I needed it, and I've never forgotten that moment or how I felt when it happened. Kindness over criticism, it is incredibly effective. Remember what Schwab said? He said, people do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval. So we just talked about how she avoided the criticism. Now let's talk for a moment about creating a spirit of approval. What can we do to create that spirit of approval? Well, one thing we can do is we can look for ways to catch them doing something right. Now, I want to point this out on purpose here, because I think it's important to have this conversation. It's not enough for you to see it and acknowledge in your mind that it was right. When you see it, you need to say it out loud. You need to say it out loud. You need to be specific, be clear, and be vocal. And that's the kind of thing that Dale Carnegie is talking about in his book. And it's what Ken Blanchard talks about in his book called Whale Done. In Blanchard's book, he notes that when it comes to training whales at SeaWorld, the trainers ignore all negative behaviors and focus their praise and reward on positive ones. Time-tested, this positivity approach works with these amazing ocean mammals, and it works with the human animal, too. What can you do to catch people doing something right? How can you begin to notice the good things that they're doing? How can you recognize them and appreciate them for their contributions, no matter how small they may seem at the time? It requires that you make it a priority to look for them doing it right, not look for them doing it wrong. But it is so counterintuitive because we are great at spotting the gap, spotting the lack, spotting the thing that doesn't fit. But what I want to encourage you to do is look for the things that do fit. Look for the things that are right. And when you see something, say something. And Bob Berg says, all things being equal, people do business with people they know, like, and trust. It's not that you have to be liked. It's just that it makes things so much easier when people like you. And during this lesson, I do not have at my command the time to teach in depth this next portion of our lesson, but I want to share with you 6 ways to make a connection with your team members. Carnegie says, become genuinely interested in other people. 2, smile. 3, remember that a person's name is to that person the sweetest and most important sound in any language. I'll tell you, that is absolutely right. And it is so easy to say, oh, I'm just no good with names. I'm going to forget your name. I'm just going to tell you right now, I'm going to forget your name. If you will make an effort to remember somebody's name, it has a big impact. 4, be a good listener. And being a good listener often means encouraging others to talk about themselves, because that's our favorite topic, right? 5, talk in terms of the other person's interest rather than your own. Talk in terms of the other person's interest. And 6, make the other person feel important, and do it sincerely. Now, of these six, I want to take a moment to talk about number six, because I think it ties in nicely with the theme that we're on tonight. And it fits in with the Charles Schwab quotes that I've shared so far during the lesson. How in the world can we make another person feel important? Well, I'll tell you, I've never met anybody who would admit that they get up in the morning to do lousy work and they set a goal of making people angry. And yet, how often do we find ourselves feeling like that is exactly what the other person's been intending to do? But once you realize that no one starts out with a goal to be bad at their job or to intend to make you mad, it can help you start to look for the good things that they are doing. The founder of Mary Kay Cosmetics, Mary Kay Ash, she said, "Pretend that every single person you meet has a sign around their neck that says, 'Make me feel important.' Not only will you succeed in sales, you will succeed in life. Even the most seemingly unimportant person can be important to your business." And I want to close this lesson with a story about Bob and the impact one conversation had on a business. Now, this story was shared by a man by the name of Ron Burley in Inc. magazine. And Ron says, "In business, we're often all about the numbers, occasionally to a fault. I'm not saying statistics and metrics aren't useful tools. Sometimes, however, the success or failure of an enterprise comes down to individual interaction, say, a handshake or a phone call. Let me give you a good example," Ron says. "In 1995, I bootstrapped a tech company, Broadcast Software. We created digital audio and automation software for broadcast radio stations, and after 4 years, we had 16 employees and customers in 40 countries. But we were at a transition point. If companies need to grow or die, we were in need of a transfusion. We had grown beyond my ability to fund future growth out of my back pocket, and it was time to get outside capital. It also turned out to be time for the tech bubble to burst. Our potential funding sources instantly disappeared. I was a hands-on CEO. I had written the original code, and I knew many of our customers personally. I told my employees that the buck stopped with me. And I'd be willing to speak with any customer they couldn't help or satisfy, and if need be, they should even give out my personal number. So, when my cell phone vibrated at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning, I recognized the 618 area code as Southern Illinois. And that meant the caller was Bob, a crusty old-time radio engineer and owner of a very small rural station near Mount Vernon. He had purchased one of our systems several months before, and he had been struggling to get it up and running. Bob's biggest problem was he had never even used a computer before. My support manager more than once had recommended that we just refund Bob's money, but we had marketed our products as easy to use, so we could not abandon someone because they had found otherwise. I climbed out of bed, closed the door behind me, and I spent the next 2 hours coaching Bob on how to configure the startup options of Microsoft Windows. This was not an issue with our software, but it was a problem for our customer, Bob, which made it our problem. At the end of the conversation, I thought we'd made a lot of progress. Bob was enthusiastic, and I was hopeful. And that was the last time anyone heard from Bob. He didn't call tech support, and he didn't call me. And as time passed, I wondered whether we'd actually fixed Bob's problem or whether he'd just given up. And I'd made a mental note to check in on him as soon as I figured out my bigger financial issues. Well, as it turns out, one situation was about to solve the other. About 6 months to the day after I'd hung up on the phone with Bob, I received another call. The chief of engineering of a major media company informed me that the company had decided to standardize on our software across its entire chain of more than 300 radio stations. It would be the biggest order in our history, more than $4 million in sales, and it would easily provide the capital that we had been so desperately needing. Now, this call was a complete surprise. We had not pursued their business. In fact, it had been public knowledge that they were selecting one of our competitors. And as it turns out, the reason for their mid-course change was Bob. That phone call with Bob saved our company. He had not given up on us. He loved us. Shortly after my call with Bob, that same media giant made an offer he could not refuse to purchase his radio station, and Bob had stayed on as a consulting engineer. Not long after, a company meeting centered on their intentions to purchase our competitor's products, and Bob raised his hand at the back of the room. "Have you ever heard of broadcast software?" He told his new colleagues the story of our phone call and how we'd stuck with him for months, even when the problems weren't really our problems. Over lunch and then dinner, Bob sang our praises. At the end of the evening, he scribbled our website and contact information on a cocktail napkin, and he handed it to the chief of engineering. "Check these guys out. They're great." They did. And the rest was history. Our history. There's a moral to the story, Ron says. Every customer needs to be treated with respect, and no customer should be left dissatisfied. I'm not saying that every customer call is crucially important, but some of them certainly are, and you never know which one might be your Bob. Ron had made Bob feel important. Important enough for a 2-hour phone call from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. to help him solve a problem he was having and to help him get through it. Making the other person feel important is very, very valuable for you. Now it's almost time for you to have your personal action plan in place. Now, as you're getting ready for that, I'm going to run through a quick recap of what we've talked about in today's lesson. First, leaders often ask, why can't people just do their dang job? Well, we have to focus on the people side and not just the tasks. Charles Schwab said, "I have yet to find the person who did not do better work and put forth greater effort under a spirit of approval than a spirit of criticism." Human connection is at the heart of all productive work. People are your work, and you need to remember that. When we take care of people, the tasks take care of themselves. Kindness is one way to establish loyalty in your team members. It builds relationships and helps them to feel really cared for. That restaurant manager I told you about, she instilled a deep loyalty in me, and I've never forgotten how she made me feel. Now, can you catch people doing something right? Creating that spirit of approval? And when you do catch them doing something right, can you say it out loud? And finally, we talked about 6 ways to make people like you, and one of them is to make the other person feel important, and to do that with sincerity. And that's what Ron did with Bob, and it won him a $4 million contract. So for your action plan, I want you to think about what's the one idea from today's lesson that you can apply, change, or teach. Now, maybe you're with your team as you're listening to this, and it's time for a group discussion. After the call ends, take a couple of minutes to talk with your team about making better connections. Now, I said early in the lesson that I would provide an opportunity for you to do more if maybe you wanted to go deeper on this topic. And I've got a 4-session mastermind coaching package on John Maxwell's little book, Relationships 101. This book encapsulates John's philosophy about people. It's the philosophy that inspired me to become a better team member and ultimately become a better leader. The cost for the 4 sessions is $249 a person, and in these 4 sessions, you're going to dive into the core of relationships and relationship building that's going to propel your work forward. This is a don't-miss program, and it's filled with practical ideas that you can put to use right away. If it sounds interesting, drop me an email, tom@brighthillgroup.com, tom@brighthillgroup.com, and we'll get it set up. Thanks for being here for today's Lead Yourself First lesson, and I am looking forward to hearing from you next time.